Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. So the armies of ancient Greece and Rome have gained legendary status. Both militaries successfully conquered much of the known world in their respective eras. But what made them so formidable? Was it technological innovation, novel strategies, or just plain old grit? Well, my guest today on the show argues that it was the Greek and Roman armies' reverence for their mythic past that made them great. His name is J.E. Linden. He goes by Ted. He's a classical scholar and the author of the book Soldiers and Ghosts, A History of Battle in Classical Antiquity. Today on the show, Ted and I discuss how the ghost of the Iliad and the Odyssey haunted Greek soldiers, the ways in which both the Greeks and the Romans ritualized warfare, and why the ancient Greeks made a competition out of pretty much everything in life. We also discuss the competing virtues of courage and discipline within the Roman army. This is a riveting conversation with some fascinating insights into ancient notions of masculinity. After the show, check out the show notes at aom.is/Linden, that's L-E-N-D-O-N, or you can get links to resources where you can delve deeper into this topic. Okay, Professor Linden, welcome to the show.
Mr. McKay, thank you very much for having me.
So your book is called Soldiers and Ghosts, and it's about battle in classic antiquity. It's talking ancient Greeks, ancient Romans. And I love this book because I'm a classics guy, but I thought it was interesting. You begin your book about ancient Greeks and ancient Romans talking about how American soldiers won't leave a fallen comrade behind, even if they're dead. And then you say that this puts them in the company of these great warrior civilizations like ancient Greece and Rome. How so?
Well, I would limit that to a certain degree to Greece, because the Romans have been much less fastidious about picking up their dead. But the Greeks were very, very finicky about this. What would happen would be that they'd have a battle, and then one side would turn to flight. And the side that was victorious would basically move forward and stand on all the bodies, not physically stand on them, but stand over them. And then the losing side would have to send a herald, who's protected by the gods, to ask the winning side for the bodies back, that is to say, the bodies of their dead. And when that happened, that was an admission of defeat. So they had this very formal way of indicating victory and defeat. And then the winning side says yes, then people from the losing side come and pick up the bodies of their people, which must have been, if you just think about it, kind of weird. I mean, you've just been fighting, and now you're sort of all sort of dragging bodies around together. Very odd. But in any event, they will then carry them home, the bodies to be buried. The winning side will build a trophy at the point where the decisive effort in the battle happened, or at the turning point, which is what trophy means in Greek, the turning. And then and that's the end of things. But as you can see, it's all very formalized. The Greeks believed that if you didn't bury someone or cremate them correctly, they would never be able to get properly into Hades and would wander around as ghosts. And that was, of course, a very bad thing to have ghosts wandering around the place. So, I mean, everybody knows the Greek custom of putting a coin under the tongue of a person who's being buried, so that they can pay the ferryman to take them over into Hades. Well, you know, burying them properly in every other respect is also very important. And the Greeks are terrified and horrified by the prospect of bodies lost at sea, because they can never be properly recovered and sent down to Hades. I mean, every classicist knows what I just told you. What interested me was to discover that that a parallel process has evolved in the American armed forces, the American armed forces will happily fight and endanger living soldiers to recover the bodies of dead soldiers. And what's interesting to me about this is that, and of course, you know, we can see the ritualized quality of it with the ceremony at the airplane when the body is taken back to the States, the ceremony at the airplane when the body arrives in the States, the military funeral, all that type of thing. It's not identical, but obviously parallel to what the Greeks are up to. What really interested me about it is we can see it happen. That is to say, unlike the Greek custom, which doesn't seem to exist in the Iliad, but exists in historical time, but we don't see it evolve, we can really see it evolve in the American case. If you read books about the Second World War, and I'm thinking here particularly of Eugene Sledge's With the Old Breed.
It's a great book.
Great book, particularly about the Battle of Okinawa. He and his comrades are very indifferent to the presence of American dead bodies. They do not feel any particular need to evacuate those bodies. And in fact, there are unpleasant scenes in which they use those bodies, they pile them up to be fortifications. So they, in that generation in the 40s, they really don't seem to have had this code. But it's very clearly very much there, particularly in the Marine Corps, but also in the other services by the Vietnam War. And my suspicion is that it derives from the Battle of Chosin Reservoir, or the retreat from Chosin Reservoir in the Korean War, where the Marines left a large number of comrades' bodies behind. And I think they sort of made a corporate decision then that they were never going to do that again. And acting on that then elaborated itself through the rest of the American services, so that this has become an important part of the American way of war. As I say, I'm interested in it because we can sort of see it evolve.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. So, like, what we're seeing then is a ritualization of warfare.
Absolutely.
Right. And so let's go back to the ancient Greeks. So they had this very elaborate ritual for what to do with the dead bodies after a battle. Were the Greeks, and we'll talk about some of the other ways that the Greeks they ritualized warfare, but were the Greeks always this ritual when it came to battle? And if not, when did this ritualization begin?
Well, to a certain degree, I mean, it appears in a kind of in a place we don't know much about. That is, we have the Iliad, and the Iliad doesn't seem to involve this anywhere near this degree of ritualization. Of course, it's fictional. It's an epic poem. It's based on material from 1200 to 700 BC, all muddled together. So it doesn't necessarily really describe a real world. But in any event, it is useful in the sense that we can say at least that at some point, it doesn't look like the Greeks did this. But when the Greeks do pop into our vision around 500 BC, they do have, it seems, this whole system of dealing with the dead already well-developed. We can't really speculate about exactly when it comes about. I personally can speculate about why it comes about, because I think it has to do with the evolution of Greek warfare to create, to make it into a more perfect competition. And one of the things that this system does is it very clearly indicates winners and losers of battles, which, of course, no other society has been quite as efficient as coming up with a way in which right after the battle, the loser admits that they lose so that there's no question about who won. It's really an astonishing, it's in many ways an astonishing human achievement if it's very important to you to have a clear indication of who won and lost. And it is important to the Greeks because not only do they compete individually between each other as people, but their city-states are fully anthropomorphized and compete as and compete with each other as if they were people. And when two Greek armies fight, it's two city-states fighting. And you want, just as you want to know very clearly who is the most brave soldier. So clearly you want to know very clearly which is the most brave city-state, and therefore you evolve methods of creating a clear victor and a clear defeated.
So this isn't right. So you talk throughout the book about this competitive drive the Greeks had. They wanted to be the best and like what arete, right? Excellence. I mean, where did this drive come from? And did other ancient cultures have the same desire for competition that the ancient Greeks had?
We cannot tell exactly where it comes from. It seems to exist very clearly in the Homeric poems, which is the earliest Greek evidence we have. And also more or less contemporaneously, Hesiod points out the problems with it, because it creates strife and civil war and various other things. So the Greeks already knew that it wasn't great. What I would say to that is that what sets the Greeks aside is their eagerness to compete in every possible realm. The people I know about most, of course, are the other people I know about most are the Romans, and they compete in war, and in being heroic in war and in politics, and in certain other limited realms, which we'll be talking about. But it would never strike the Romans to consider, for example, bird interpretation as a competitive enterprise, or abusing people as a competitive enterprise, as it appears in the Iliad, or steering a ship as a competitive enterprise. The thing about the Greeks is that they elaborate this so that there's nothing is left cooperative. Everything is made competitive. And if you wish to get five ancient Greeks to cooperate with each other, the best way to do so is simply to announce the fact that you're going to have a competition in being cooperative. Otherwise, it really won't work. They do not develop. Some people think they develop later. I don't, frankly. But they really do not develop cooperative virtues. And they organize a society which is carefully based on exploiting competitive virtues. So that, for example, in classical Athens, they don't have taxes. What they do is they ask the richest people in the society to contribute to the great expenses of the society, to keep creating warships and organizing plays and things like that. But it's intensely competitive. The best warship of the year gets a prize. The best play of the year gets a prize. We know that about all the tragedies, right? That some of them win and some of them don't. But that's how they fund their entire state. Essentially by creating a series of competitions among the richest people, and letting the poor people, who are perceived to be perhaps either less competitive or less useful in this sort of respect, mostly have a free ride.
It's interesting. So let's go back to the title of your book. It's Soldiers and Ghosts. And you argue throughout the book that both the Greeks and the Romans, particularly the Greeks, they were haunted by the ghost of their past, and that the innovations they made in warfare was directed by this tradition. For the Greeks, it came from the Iliad, the Homeric epics. So let's talk about some of the rules that the Greeks got from the Homeric epics on what made a good battle, right? So like, for example, the Greeks were particularly concerned about glory and honor in battle. And you see this in the Homeric epics. So you talk about some of the weird customs or rules about, you know, the governance of, you know, who got glory and honor and who didn't, and how this was inspired by the Iliad.
Yes, the Greeks do look back continuously, and one of the things that I particularly got interested in is the way in which, although in around 500, in the Persian Wars, in 480, 479, there seemed to be quite a lot of archers in Greece. That is to say, archers are a normal part of Greek armies, or at least the Athenian army. That by the 4th century BC, archers seem to have disappeared. And that's very odd, you'd think, because this is an effective technology. There's nothing wrong with the bows that they use. There's no technological reason for this. And what's even more surprising is that they tend to be replaced by a type of light infantry who throw javelins, and when they run out of javelins, throw rocks. And you think, wow, you know, that's peculiar. Now, Greece has a lot of rocks, but there aren't a lot of other armies of which I know which have institutionalized the throwing of rocks, as it were, or have preferred systematically have made the choice to prefer javelins, which of course have a very short range, to arrows, which have a much longer range. And so this seems to be a case of actually technological devolution. And my thinking on it is that javelins, or the throwing of spears specifically, is unquestionably heroic in the Iliad. There's no question that every hero, that's one of the ways you fight. You stab with your spear, but you also throw your spear. There's never any criticism of that. That's regarded as firmly heroic. The same is true of throwing rocks. But archery is regarded in the poem as dubiously heroic. There are at least two different ways of looking at it. The actual archers, people like Pandarus, for example, think of what they do is heroic. But a lot of other people basically say, no, archery is not heroic. If you want to be a true hero, you must stand face to face to the enemy with the enemy and fight him close in. And that is probably more people say that in the Iliad than praise archery.
That's interesting. So there's this idea like the archery was kind of wussy.
Archery was kind of wussy. And my argument, my way of thinking is that it is this influence that spear throwing is clearly heroic while archery is dubiously heroic, which operating over time in the minds of the Greeks finally drives archery out of their way of fighting and replaces it with spear throwing.
And so the other aspect that the Greeks looked to the Iliad, the Homeric epics, was this idea of one-on-one battle, single combat, right? You see in the Iliad instances where there's sort of like this battle going on, but then Homer calls out two fighters, Hector and Achilles, and they fight one-on-one. Mm-hmm. What did the Greeks do to, I don't know, some in a way replicate or give homage to that idea of, you know, single combat while still fighting as a unit?
Well, for a very long time, they simply still do single combat. I mean, we have long lists of people. This is mostly before 500. We have long lists of single combat victors that they still had the custom of actual challenge before battle. And guy would come out and say, you know, I am such and such. I challenge you. I challenge anyone from your army to come out and fight you. And indeed, there's an Athenian we know by the name of Sophonies who we're told defeated numerous opponents in this way. And he's still alive at the Battle of Plataea. So this is something they're still doing just before the lights come up on Greek history. But my view is that the problem with single combat in reality is that it produces very confused battlefields. And if you have groups at the one hand fighting and single people fighting, it's very difficult to tell. It's very difficult to tell who has been heroic and who has not. And so in my view, what the Greeks did was removed in order to keep the heroic quality of combat, in order to keep it competitive. They removed themselves, withdrew from the mixed combat of the Iliad, and instead said, okay, we're going to compete in one thing, and we're going to compete in one thing that is very easily judged, and that one thing is standing your ground. Because if you're sort of placed in a matrix, it's fairly clear to everyone around you whether you stand your ground or don't. And that is what I think the phalanx is, ultimately. The mass formation of the classical Greeks, in which the heavy-armed hoplite fights, it's a way of testing individual soldiers to see who is the bravest by who can stand his ground the longest. But since the phalanx also represents the city, It's a way of testing the city-state to see which city-state has the same sort of courage. One of the things that makes it so useful to the Greeks is that it's the perfect analogy in that you test the same thing at both levels, and that's what they want to do. They want to test. They want the bravest man to whom they can give an award, which they do after the battle, sometimes second and third place too. But they also want to know which city is bravest. So they come up with this somewhat un-Homeric, or at least debated in Homer, a form of heroism, which is standing your ground. They make that the primary form, and they organize a system of fighting around it so that they can tell in the real world, who is the bravest. Whilst if you try to replicate Homeric fighting in the real world, it's incredibly confusing and chaotic. And you're not going to be able to tell who the bravest is.
Right. So this is interesting. So, and I thought what was interesting too, is you argue that, you know, the phalanx, it's not a really effective way of warfare. I mean, a more effective way would be sort of guerrilla tactics, right? But as you said, this allows the city states and individual Greeks to know who's the best. So it's off. I mean, it really is, phalanx battle is like a football game in a lot of ways.
Yeah. I mean, it's highly rules bound in ways. I mean, not only in respect, we've already talked about what happens after battle, but before battle, there's also a series of things that sort of has to happen. Everybody lines up. You don't actually agree on a time to fight, but in practice, you tend to wait for the other guys to be lined up. You advance. You sing a hymn to the god Apollo called the Paean. There are sacrifices to make sure that the gods are on your side. You sing. There's a special magic shout to Ares, the Enyalios shout, and so forth. And this is all, again, very, of course, it's religious and therefore has a certain degree an independence from pure military considerations. But the fact that everyone employs exactly the same religious ritual or very similar religious ritual before a battle and up to the point of contact suggests, again, a very high degree of ritualization. And precisely as you say, that we're talking here about something which they conceive to be very much what we would call a sport. They, of course, have sports too. But the Greeks have a particular genius for generating rules, for generating competitive rules, which is why, of course, they have the Olympics and they have organized athletics in a world where that is not particularly common. Or at least much less prominent. To the Greeks, organized athletics are one of the major things that interest them. And what this tells us is that they have this genius for coming up with rules to make things fair so that you can tell who is the best.
So going back to this idea of standing your ground, this is interesting because this was a way the Greeks were inspired by the Homeric epics of displaying courage. But because they couldn't do it in single combat, they evolved it. They changed it a bit, where they changed courage to mean stand your ground. Are there particular battles or instances where this idea of courage meaning stand your ground really comes into play?
Yes, absolutely. Let me begin simply by saying that standing your ground is kind of like archery. It is an equivocal virtue in the Iliad. You've got some people saying, we're big heroes, we have to stand our ground. And you've got other people saying, we don't actually have to do this if it's going to get us killed. And then you've got other people who clearly simply don't stand their ground, whatever they think about it. So Homeric warfare is much more fluid, with people going back and forth, and famously, people notice the way in which you're allowed to leave the battlefield if you want a drink or a meal. You can hang around in the tents for as long as you want, have long discussions, which are reproduced by Homer, with your friends, and then go back to the battle. So it's all very relaxed compared to later Greek warfare. When you get into the later period, they have made a clear decision that the Homeric poems did not, that standing your ground is heroic, and specifically that it is the most heroic thing that you can do, that they're going to define heroism quite narrowly in terms of standing your ground. And then if you want to get a sense of its importance, you'll remember the stand of the 300 Spartans at Thermopylae when the Persians attack. This is in 480 BC, and they basically fight and they fight and they fight until they are all killed, heroically standing their ground. And the poet Simonides writes the famous epitaph, which we all know: "A stranger, go tell the Spartans that we lie here according to their laws." The law is the law to stand your ground. Since that is the Spartan law, they all die there. And of course, the stranger is needed to go tell the Spartans because they're all dead, and none of them can do it themselves.
It's wedding season, and while weddings are all about the bride and groom, they're also a chance for you to look your best. With a fully custom suit from Indochino, you'll walk into wedding season looking like $1 million, even though suits start at just $499. It's easier than ever to be the best dressed with Indochino. Order your custom suits now, and they'll be ready for wedding season. The process of customizing a suit on Indochino, very easy to do. It's also a lot of fun. I've talked about my navy blue suit I've gotten from Indochino. First off, you can decide how the jacket is, how you want the pockets on the jacket to be, how you want the lapels, the vent on the back, the lining. On the pants, you can decide you want pleats or no pleats. I went no pleats on my pants on this one. And then you do the measuring process. You'll need someone to help you, but they have this very easy-to-follow guide. Send that all in a few weeks, you have a custom made-to-measure suit sent directly to your door, and you're going to pay about the same price for a suit that you'd pay for an off-the-rack suit at a department store. Look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com today and use code MANLINESS to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's Indochino.com, promo code MANLINESS. Check it out today. If you're like me, you've probably signed up for subscription services, but then you forgot about them. I'm talking about newsletters, streaming services, things like that. Well, with the personal finance app Rocket Money, it can help you find and cancel your unwanted subscriptions. It can also monitor your spending and help you lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. I had a chance to use Rocket Money, connected it to my checking account, and it found a bunch of subscription services that I forgot about. I was able to cancel them, and I was able to save a lot of money because the stuff adds up. Besides canceling your unwanted subscriptions, Rocket Money will even try to negotiate lower bills for you, up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. They'll deal with customer service for you. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/manliness. That's rocketmoney.com/manliness. rocketmoney.com/manliness. Have you ever been to an event where you just had to get the best seats? Like maybe it was a concert for your favorite band, or maybe it was an important game for your favorite team. Well, to do that, you had to set an alarm to get the tickets as soon as they went on sale. When you want the best, you have to act quickly, or someone else will get it instead. It's like if you are trying to hire for your business and you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. So what's the best way to do that? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast, and right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best people fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/manliness, MANLINESS. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. All right, picture that thing you've always wanted to learn. Now picture learning it from the person who's literally the best at it in the world. That's what you get with MasterClass. This year, learn from the best to become your best with MasterClass. MasterClass offers over 180 world-class instructors, and a lot of them are former AOM podcast guests. So for example, you can learn The Art of Negotiation from Chris Voss. We had him on the podcast. Leadership from Jocko Willink, another AOM podcast guest. Writing from Malcolm Gladwell, another AOM podcast guest. You name it, MasterClass has it. With MasterClass, you get unlimited access to intimate one-on-one classes with the world's best. Plus, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so there's no risk. So I did the masterclass with Chris Voss on negotiation. Very well done. He talks about tactical empathy, how to mirror somebody so that you can develop rapport with them. So if you enjoyed that podcast I did with Chris Voss several years ago about his book, Never Split the Difference, you're going to love this masterclass. And right now, AOM listeners will get an additional 15% off an annual membership at masterclass.com/AOM. Get 15% off right now at masterclass.com/AOM. masterclass.com/AOM. Check out the negotiation class with Chris Voss. So let's shift gears here. We've been talking about the ancient Greeks. Let's talk about the ancient Romans. So the Greeks had the Iliad to guide them in their approach to war. That's the tradition they looked to. What guided the Romans in their development of their warlike ethos?
That's an interesting question because, of course, the Romans only start writing, at least so far as we know, things that survived to us around 200 BC. And their city is founded, according to legend, in 753 BC. And so they have a very, very long period, which is essentially unhistorical to us. But they clearly have legends. And much of the early material we have is about their legends. And it's always been said, it's always been said that history, even their mythical history, their own mythical history, is the Iliad and the Odyssey to the Romans. And so they basically preserve a series of stories about their early leaders and about how things were in the old days, and that they model themselves on those particular individual people, but without it being, shall we say, canonized in epic poetry. These are stories that are handed down in families and told mother to child and things like that, an oral tradition, which of course is like exactly like the Iliad and the Odyssey, which are oral poems for a very long time. But they're the property of professional bards who memorize them and recite them, and that doesn't seem to be the case of the old Roman legends about their doings in early times.
So let's talk about how the Romans fought. So the Greeks had the phalanx, and the Romans eventually adopted the phalanx. But how did the Romans fight in the early days of Rome or the Republic?
Well, I mean, before the Romans adopt the phalanx, we really don't know. Because we don't have any useful records or useful archaeological information. We have a few hints. There's a very early temple to Castor and Pollux, who are of course borrowed from Greeks. We've got the two Greek brother gods, but they are closely associated both in the Greek and Latin tradition with cavalry. So there might have been some fighting on horseback. But the truth is, we simply cannot in honesty tell how they fought before they adopted the Greek phalanx. What we can tell is that the Greek phalanx did not agree with them, because by the time we see them clearly, they've abandoned the Greek phalanx, or not exactly abandoned it, but collapsed it in such a fashion that individual Roman soldiers can fight as heroic individuals, much like people fight in the Iliad. So that rather than, like the Greeks, deciding the Iliad method of single combat doesn't really work, so we're going to do the phalanx, the Romans take the phalanx and they adapt it to allow for individual fighting, particularly before battle, in which the young men in the first rank, in the velites, are competing with one another to challenge the enemy. This is also true of the cavalry, which is made up of the most noble of the young men, the richest. They're challenging each other to single combats, and the whole system, rather than being a block, is much more messy. Because it's intended to allow for single combats to develop, and that is, to my mind, how you get from the phalanx, which we know they used, to the classical republican form of Roman fighting, which is in the so-called manipular legion, in which the army is divided up into small clumps of men. Rather than simply in an enormous block like the phalanx of old.
And were the Romans, like the Greeks, leery of technological advances because it would somehow rob them of honor and glory in battle?
Yeah, I mean, you don't... you will notice that the Romans, much like the Greeks, never make archery a significant part of their military thing. And this is true even under the Roman Empire. They disliked, both the Romans and the Greeks disliked the random factor. And I think they particularly associated archery and the fact that, you know, you've got a bunch of people, you know, in a swarm who shoot off a bunch of arrows, and they you cannot tell whose arrow has hit anybody. So you cannot tell who the heroic person was who shot the arrow, and the arrows strike randomly, and they will strike equally brave and cowardly. And that won't do. I mean, the point is that however you organize the fighting, it has to distinguish between the brave and the cowardly so that the brave will prevail or at least die heroically, not being shot by an arrow, and so that the cowards will be shown to be cowards. And archery just doesn't do that very well.
Okay. So also within the Romans, you talk about these two competing ethoses, these ideas of virtus and disciplina.
Ah, you can tell you've had a classical education because you pronounce it virtus, which virtus is how a classicist would pronounce it. Of course, it begins with a V, and a boring old historian like me tends to pronounce it virtus. All it means, of course, is manliness, it becomes the word for it becomes the word for courage, or starts as the word for courage. I should point out that this is true both in Greek and Latin, that they don't make a linguistic distinction between manliness and courage. So in Latin, you have virtus, manliness. In Greek, you have andrea, which also means manliness and courage at the same time. They don't feel they need a linguistic distinction between the two qualities. Something which your magazine should contemplate and be delighted by. What to my mind happens is that you have a very old culture of single combat at Rome. That certainly is what, if the records mean anything, that is suggested. But that makes fighting in formation of any sort very difficult. And so my argument is that the Romans also developed this countervailing ethos, disciplina, which of course translates into discipline in English, but also means things like, you know, hard work. So if you're asked to dig a ditch, that's a question of disciplina. That whilst the individual soldiers compete in the one in virtus, the officers, the leaders, compete in disciplina to try to keep order among all these young men who wish to fight in individual combat. And the result of this conflict is ultimately the manipular legion, but it's a happy conflict in that it manages to keep the Romans sufficiently organized so that they can win battles on the big scale. That's disciplina, but also allow them fight individually in a heroic fashion on the small scale. That's virtus, which makes them incredibly ferocious individually.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about how far the Romans took this disciplina, how serious they took. I think you mentioned an instance where a general killed his own son, executed his own son for cowardice because he didn't show disciplina.
Well, it's not for cowardice. He's too brave. This is a war in which this is Manlius Torquatus, who himself early in life, Manlius Torquatus is challenged to a single combat by an enormous Gaul, and gets permission and goes out and fights it, kills the Gaul and takes his necklace, his torque, which is why he is thereafter called Manlius Torquatus, Manlius the torque guy, right? So he gets older, And there is another war, but this is a war not against Gauls, but against Latins, that is to say, people who are linguistically and culturally the same as the Romans. And that produces the possibility of severe confusion if there is single combat. So the general Manlius Torquatus on this one occasion forbids single combat. But his son, who wishes to be proven as brave as his father, goes out and ignores the rule and participates in single combat, and then brings the spoils, the armor, back and lays them before his father and says, "Look, father, I'm just as glorious as you were." And then his father has him executed for the violation of disciplina. So yes, you've got that's the sort of test case for the two things in conflict. It is of interest that this becomes a sort of gross tradition in the house of the Manlii Torquati, and this is not the only one of their own sons that they execute. They develop a custom of doing this, execute a number of their sons in subsequent years, or those sons, knowing that they are going to be executed, commit honorable suicide.
Wow. Yeah. So they take it really serious. And how did these two conflicting ethoses develop or evolve as Rome transitioned from a republic to an empire? Was there a degradation of the two, or did one take precedent over the other?
Well, I mean, the Romans clearly think that both have to be kept going really very strongly, and that is what they want to do. The peril is that when you have a professional army, they're going to become better at disciplina, because, of course, under the empire, the Romans do have the world's first long service professional army, with soldiers serving for 25 years and things like that, paid salaries. There's always a peril that things are going to flop over to the disciplina side, and that although they will be, you know, that they will be well trained and well disciplined, they will not be as brave. And so the Romans actually work very hard at keeping the virtus side going. Partially, it's their system of military decorations. They have the first system of which we know of military decorations. The Greeks give prizes for being the best, but the Romans just give prizes for doing various heroic things, like say, the life of another soldier and things like that, much more like our system. But their particular technique is simply, because the Greeks think you can teach courage. This is, of course, debated in Plato at considerable length, but that basically seems to be their view. The Romans don't really think you can teach courage. And if they think that they're getting people without the right courage to be soldiers, they will simply search until they find people who are brought up right, or who have the right courage in their blood. And so what you tend to get is the fact that they start recruiting people from wilder and wilder areas of the empire. As the empire becomes more civilized, the Italians cease to want to fight, but then you've got all these Gauls who maintain a military tradition and who have lots of virtus. You can give them disciplina, you cannot give them virtus. So the recruiters first go out into the Gallic provinces, and then in later years into Spain, and then after that, particularly onto the German frontier onto the Balkan frontier. And although they would not probably publicly say it, a lot of these people who are actually joining the Roman army are probably really barbarians from over the border, who are taken in because they are really, really brave. And the Romans know that they can discipline them, but they cannot generate bravery. Over time, it seems to me you can argue that a practical distinction develops between the Roman soldier troops, or rather the Roman citizen troops, the legions, who seem to be prized particularly for things like engineering, and the non-Roman citizen troops who tend to be from wilder areas. These are the so-called auxiliaries, They seem to be prized more for actual fighting because they have more virtus than the legions. And we can see this reflected in Tacitus, but we can also see it particularly in Trajan's column, where if you count up the fights all the way up the column, you realize that most of the fighting is being done by the auxiliaries, and surprisingly little of the fighting is being done by the Roman citizen legionaries, who are instead depicted building, making roads, cutting down forests, they appear a lot, but they appear mostly in engineering or parading capacities.
Very interesting. So, Ted, you argue in the book that the Greeks, like the Greeks, the Romans reverenced the past. But you argue that while the Greek reverence for their past made Greek armies better, Rome's reverence for their military past made their armies worse. How so?
Well, my argument is that the Greek military history is a series of experiments to try to recreate the Homeric epics. The phalanx, which we've already talked about, is one of those things. But actually, they get better at this as things go on. And Philip II, the king of Macedonia, the father of Alexander, produces another set of experiments based, at least we're told, on various passages in the Iliad, which make a far more effective army than the Greeks had previously. He then, of course, defeats the Greeks and goes and is murdered, and then his son briefly defeats the Greeks again, but then goes off and creates this incredible world empire. So Alexander is phenomenally successful, and he is successful with an army that his father created on the basis of looking back at the Iliad, and also because his own soldiers coming from Macedonia have not been civilianized in the way that that a lot of the rest of the Greeks have been, and are in fact sort of much more Homeric in their outlook. So if they're Homeric in their outlook and they're fighting in a Homeric way, or think they are, this makes for a very effective thing.
Very interesting.
My argument about the Romans is that they lose confidence because particularly in the late 2nd and 3rd century, they start having military setbacks. And the 3rd century is, of course, terrible, not only with multiple invasions by barbarians, but also by a lot of civil war and economic collapse and general misery. That they lose confidence in their own military tradition. In the ways they have been fighting over a very, very long time, because it doesn't seem to be effective anymore. But they are, of course, because they're an ancient people, they're still very past-minded. So what they do is decide, okay, well, our own traditions aren't helping us here. Let's use the Greek traditions. So what you see in the 4th century AD is the revival of what is essentially a phalanx army. That is to say that the Romans go back to an army which would have been, which is recognized, particularly among the infantry, recognizably the same in equipment and in tactics as the Greeks in the 5th century would have been. That's to say, even before Philip II. Now, there's a certain weird logic to this, because as one author says, well, the only folk among us of the Westerners who have ever defeated the Persians were the Greeks. So if we're now losing to the Persians, we should naturally fight like the Greeks did. And you know, we think, well, that's very odd logic, but if you revere the past as much as the Romans and the Greeks did, that makes sense. So what you end up with is a Roman army, which is a throwback not to Roman military tradition, but to Greek military tradition, which is, as a result, somewhat inflexible and brittle in the way that the Roman army had not been before. That is to say, in the earlier centuries in the Republic and in the earlier empire. It seems to me that you can make a case that this is, in fact, although it is a historical recreation, it's not a good historical recreation, unlike Philip II's, who made a better army with a historical recreation. The Romans make a worse army because the phalanx is simply just not as effective as the way the Romans themselves used to fight. Something, had the Romans thought about it, they should have been able to tell, because, of course, they had defeated themselves, the people, with their own methods of warfare that fought in these ways. But they were in a desperate situation. They knew they needed to make some change. They had no confidence in their own tradition. And so they adopt this ancient Greek way of fighting, which proves to be less effective.
Very interesting. Well, Ted, this has been a great conversation. Where can people learn more about your work and your book, Soldiers and Ghosts?
Well, the easiest way is to go to the library and read it. In fact, that's in practice the best way to proceed. There are of course various book reviews and things like that, but the book is now quite old, and so it's still universally available. Putting your hands on an old review would be quite tricky. Again, I just say ultimately people should probably read the thing. It's written for people who are not academics. That is to say, it is written to be interesting to people other than college professors. I try to write in a lively style. So a reader will not be overwhelmed with boredom and horror as the normal reader is when faced with an academic book.
Well, I can concur. I can vouch that this is true. It's a highly engaging, very readable book. Well, Ted, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Well, thank you, Brett, for having me on the show. I'm extremely grateful.
My guest today was Ted Linden, or J.E. Linden. He's the author of the book Soldiers and Ghosts, available on Amazon.com and bookstores everywhere. You can also check out the show notes for more information about what we talked about today at aom.is/Linden. Well, that wraps up another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. For more manly tips and advice, make sure to check out the Art of Manliness website at artofmanliness.com. And if you enjoy the show and have got something out of it, I'd appreciate it if you give us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. Helps us out a lot. As always, thank you for your continued support. And until next time, this is Brett McKay telling you to stay manly.